able to do something better by this time. The other concept was that if the soul is a structure composed of atoms, that it is quite conceivable that these two structures can exist in the same place at the same time, and that they are also capable of separating and returning to each other. That whichever form, as Pythagoras says, is the more subtle, must permeate that which is less subtle. Socrates uses a rather common concept of this, and has since been very popular. Namely, that you can fill a glass with sand, and when it is entirely full, you can then take a cup of water and pour that into the glass. The reason being that we are working with two different groups of atomic structures, one of which can penetrate the other, only for one reason, as Democritus also pointed out, and that is that in the atomic structure, the atoms, though forming a mass, actually do not constitute a solid. In other words, if we could magnify this structure sufficiently, we would discover that no two atoms touch each other. They come into proximity, they meet, but they seem to meet by another quality. And this other quality is the fact that the atom itself is a kind of double nucleus, one which we know today, and which we have attempted in various ways to bombard. If this be conceived possible, as the Greeks held it, then the soul could permeate the body. It could enter and depart from it, moving between the atoms of the body. By the same means, the soul could move through a door that is closed, because the atoms in the wood are not in the same quantity-quality relationship as the atoms in the soul. But two doors striking each other will not so penetrate each other. Consequently, the soul has a power of approaching and moving into unity with substance. And when these two meet, something new is created, namely an increasing density. Because now we have the soul atoms filling in some of the spaces between the physical atoms. If we wish to go still further and assume with Pythagoras the existence of a spiritual substance composed of a still more refined type of atom, then this in turn could permeate both of the others. And we would therefore be capable of having in one place three atomic structures united in one compound, the parts of which might be referred to as spirit, soul, and body. Out of this type of philosophizing also came the problem of immortality. Immortality, to the Greek atomists, was very difficult to explain in terms of a universe composed only of atoms and vacuum. They did go so far, however, as to be a little dogmatic, and after all, you must defend your principles if you believe them. And they decided that if there were such places as heaven, earth, and hell, they were obviously composed of atoms. That heaven was built up of some kind of an atomic aggregate, less visible, more subtle,
but no less factual than the physical earth upon which we walk. And of course, they had us all, and they always have had us, on one point. Namely, if this mystery could produce the earth, it can produce almost anything else. So there, it's only a degree of the incredible that we have to deal with. Also, if there were these regions in space, they were they were not essentially different from the elemental or elementary disbursements on the earth. There are vast regions we call ocean, most of which have never been explored. There are other regions which we call mountainous, still others that we call level plains or valleys. There are elements of air, of water, of fire, and of earth. And these are all present in the mysterious compound of nature. Most of these elements are comparatively invisible, except in very large aggregations. But if there can be a world of water and a world of air, there can also be a world of ether, a world of mysterious regions extending around us or even permeating us. The Greeks went so far as to speculate that many universes, all composed of atoms, but all keyed to different vibratory core motions, could exist in the same place at the same time. That the distance from here to some other order of existence might not even be measurable in any interval whatsoever. As we move our hand through the air, we may be moving it through the palace of the king of an invisible world. We do not know, and we still don't. But if we must go on with this speculation, and the Greek felt he had to, it then came to his conclusion, or he came to the conclusion, that the invisible universe of gods, of demons, of spirits, of any kind of religious being, that these could only be other forms of atomic compounds. Now, what the Greeks called the gods, according to Democritus, were actually beings composed of atoms, as man is, but more subtle, because more subtle, more refined by nature, for this reason also more erudite, more intuitive, more mystically aware, and because of having a finer nature, being capable of permeating or penetrating other things. But other things, being of a grosser nature, could not penetrate them. Therefore, the pattern of understanding itself, an atomic process, would make it possible for the superior to understand the lesser, but not permit the lesser to understand the superior. Therefore, the individual, lacking the refinement, which we might even measure in terms of brain cell structure, is limited in his possibility to comprehend, whereas another creature with a more finely organized atomic structure might comprehend him. This being the conceivable situation, what then is the power of the gods in the thinking of the atomists? The same kind of power that would be available to a most venerable and learned person who, having exceeded all worldly insight, all knowledge such as we may possess, was able, because of finer organic structure, meaning atomic structure, capable of a superior consciousness existence. and abiding in a region or place more subtle than our own, and therefore incomprehensible to us. This did not mean that the atomists assumed that this superior being created the earth. He could not so assume, because he believed the creative process to be eternal. Therefore, the deities become more in the concept of the Hermetic adepts. They become beings capable of exercising a greater directive power over structure, but were not responsible for the creation of that structure. That even these beings must abide by and obey the simple law of necessity upon which the entire creation moves. If a being, then, by process of disintegration, departs from one atomic structure by focal awareness to another atomic structure, what then, shall we say, actually happens? The atomists would tell us that the psychic structure, the psychic field, or the psychic atomic entity could not possibly enter into the compound of matter, or the lower form of atomic instrument, and there become bound, held, or fettered. This psychic atomic being could comprehend matter, could choose to abide in it, could choose to depart from it, but could not be bound to it. Furthermore, in man, there are evidences of two processes of function going on continuously. The Greek atomists decided that man had two minds. One of these minds arising from the atomic structure of the body. The other arising from the more subtle atomic structure of the soul. But this is itself a bit of a problem, because we've suddenly introduced mind into something where we have as yet provided no place for mind. We have still only atoms, motion, and vacuum. So now we have to try to figure out what the mind factor really means. I think what they would want us to realize is that the atom itself, as we now know, while it is a unit, and while it is theoretically indestructible, although we attempt and have apparently been able to crack it. But the concept is that the atom itself, although it is a unit, is also a compound. Therefore, an atom, being composed of a certain number of different parts within itself, the structures created by the aggregation of atoms, are compound structures, not simple structures. In other words, from these various procedures, it means that when the atoms unite, more than one type of unity is established. There is a unity set up for each of the parts of the atom. Now, the Greeks appeared to assume that emotion and thought are actually aggregates of certain parts of atoms, not separated from the atom, but resulting from the uniting of many atoms. A compound is set up representing either emotional or mental processes. The mind itself having apparently two natures intrigued them a lot. Apparently the highest parts of the physical atom pattern became a sort of custodian of the rest, and certain laws, the necessity principle was released through the atomic compound. This necessity principle led to the primary intellection of man, namely survival. That the individual lived to gratify whatever seemed to bring pleasure to the body in which he lived, to gratify the appetites of the atomic unit. Now, we are not sure what these appetites are. And the Greeks, frankly, held with Buddha that these appetites are not real. It was supposed that most of the atomists were addicted to a cult of pleasure. This is not strictly true, because their idea of pleasure was normalcy, simply the process of living well, not the process of indulging the faculties or the sensory perceptions. But the kind of mentation that was obviously associated with the grosser atomic structure of body was assumed to perish with it. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. The soul of the body died with it. But the Greeks also recognized that there was another kind of soul, a being living in a region of its own, that by necessity, again, this soul came into a certain fraternity with body. But the purposes of this soul were not essentially body purposes. For this soul was capable of creativity, of imagination, of genius, of great idealism, of poetry, art, drama, music, morality, religion, and ethics. That this soul could ponder imponderables, that it could reach out as the only creature that we know that is truly concerned with its own destiny and is conceivably willing and able to cooperate in the attainment of destiny. This soul, therefore, was believed to be simply another person, a person of better character and nobler purposes. This is not infallibly so, because it could be that the soul has been corrupted by circumstances, or has compromised its own existence, or has transformed its natural psychic aptitudes into destructive courses, and therefore has become a corrupted soul. But normally speaking, the soul was regarded as a friend of the body, therefore brought into communion with it, but not dependent upon it for either its insight or its inward life. The soul, naturally existing in its own condition, was therefore a contemplative body, which could survive without the support of body, physical body. But the physical body could not be purposeful without the cooperation of the soul. Yet the body could survive under certain conditions, separation from the soul. But if it did so, it became an idiot, or a thing without any inner psychic guidance. This also then brought into a new concept the Pythagorean theory of monad, namely that body, being composed of a mass of minute units, ultimately attempted to affirm its own archetypal unity over the total. Therefore, all things being composed of parts, all parts in turn are impelled to a state of unity. Thus the soul is not only made up of atoms, but by aggregate, it is a compound atom. Body composed of atoms becomes also a compound atom. The moment the body or the soul or any unit becomes a complete atom or is united to form a total unity or a monadal existence, this complete unity or the new atom, the mass atom, now reasserts its original condition, namely, that it exists in vacuum, that it is atom, vacuum, and motion. This also means that this soul, as Socrates tells us, quantitatively begins to move. And according to its nature, it moves into proximity with other atoms compounded like itself. When this occurs in the course of the building of culture, we find savagery give place to civilization, isolation to community existence, and we find the gradual enrichment of comradeship in every part of life. Further than this more or less accidental or incidental relationship, however, is that this compound, moving obliquely, like the atoms of which it is composed, begins to move in an ascending arc. An ascending arc, in this case, has one essential difference from a descending arc. Things falling fall precipitously and striking other things, shatter them or scatter them, as in the case of the pool balls. Things ascending, however, move slowly. Their motion is less rapid, and the confusion of the descending object and the probability of the ascending unit striking or disintegrating other units is lessened. Consequently, to the Greeks, this oblique ascent meant that gradually the ascending soul moved out of the area of the falling atoms and came to a state of comparative rest. The ascension of soul, therefore, was an infinite movement upward in an infinite vacuum, going on and on and on. If the motion is only in vacuum, then quality has to have some other explanation or some other interpretation. The only other possible interpretation is that this compound atom differs from the primary atom in one respect, namely, that it is now composed of an infinite number of parts. These infinite parts, having resulted in a series of compounds, it is as though you took a compound chemical and united it with another compound chemical. In this case, you would increase the compound elements. Out of this increase by compound, in which a number of different patterns react upon each other within the structure itself, there arises what the atomists call friction. This friction, in turn, becomes the basis of a certain, not psychic consciousness now, but the releasing of the fire principle in the atom. They were quite definite as to what this all meant. And to them, this began to explain what you might term the spirituality of the atom. That gradually, the atom was brought, the compound of the atom was brought to a certain state. In this state, all of its elements were more and more complicated, until finally the individual existed in the midst of an almost incomprehensible complexity. To a certain measure, we are in this state now, of this incredible diversity. Not only diversity in life around us, but diversity in quality within us. To break from this diversity again, there has to be some kind of a process. And the ancients, to a measure, seem to have anticipated a direct procedure by means of which the compound was dissolved. I think that if we had tried to understand what they would have meant by the splitting of the atom, by this mysterious process of the release of a tremendous energy, that they would have expressed it in the idea that by a certain act of volition, a bombarding of the compound with certain concepts, consciousness, energies, methods, disciplines, that the compound could be brought to a point where it sundered, where the entire atomic structure fell apart. And in so doing, the entire mysterious, intangible quotient that had been built up by all of this compounding was suddenly reduced again to its most primary nature. I suspect that this is almost the basis of Buddhistic philosophy. The concept being that the illumination or the Mahaparinirvana of Buddha was the splitting of the atom. That it was the voluntary demolishment of the chain of atomic sequences which had been set up by the entire process of evolution and generation. Man being bound by generation to evolutional process continues to complicate his nature until finally he reaches what has been termed the stage of enlightenment. Now, in the description of the transfiguration of Jesus, or in the description of the crucifixion, or in the case of the illumination of Buddha, and again, in the ultimate consuming of Buddha, at the time of the great decease, or the end of life, as represented and unfolded in the Dhammapada, we have always the same story. At the time of the death of Christ, the veil of the temple was rent from top to bottom. The earth opened. Tremendous cataclysms moved the deep. The sky was clouded. And a vast light was seen. In the case of Buddha, it is said at the moment of the Mahaparinirvana, the blaze of glory from the released consciousness extended beyond the duration of 10 universes. And as this builds up and piles up in fictional account, it seems as though what we are being told is the tremendous release of the universality of life energy. That this release, in a sense, is not the reduction of the atom or the destruction of it, but is the sudden and instantaneous reversal of the entire process of atomic structure and structural building. Now, if the Greeks had been confronted with a simple problem of what would have happened had the atom been split, conceiving that the indivisible could be divided, I rather think from the writings of Pythagoras and some of the Neoplatonic thinkers that their conclusion would then be that the dissolution or the breaking up of the unity of an atom would and would have to be the greatest consternation that could exist in the universe, for the reason that in this there would be the transition between ends and non-ends. If in an instant the energy of being, even of the most minute being, is suddenly and instantaneously released in vacuum, this would represent the most terrible combustion of which the human consciousness can conceive, because it would be the sudden annihilation of a thing. If this annihilation was voluntary, as in the Parinirvana, it meant the return of the being to the state of pure life. In the case of the atomic thinker, among the older people certainly, it would represent the sudden revelation of the total potential of this mysterious thing called the atom. Now, the atom, according to the Greek, had no peculiar qualities of its own. Vacuum had no peculiar qualities of its own. But when atom, as thing, moves into vacuum as not thing, it makes the longest and most terrific journey that is conceivable by the human mind. For the transformation of thing to not thing is as incredible as the transformation from not thing to thing. This would mean that atom potentially had one point in common with vacuum, namely that atom was capable of being diffused in vacuum. That atom released into vacuum expands indefinitely and infinitely. That this transformation then would conceivably be the greatest change that can exist or could occur anywhere in space. Now, if this atom suddenly is actually dissipated in vacuum, it might have somewhat the same relationship as a moving object passing through the sound barrier. This atom would have to pass through the quality, time, motion, energy barrier between being and not being. Atom as would have to suddenly reverse its polarity and attain identity with vacuum. I believe that this would be interpreted in ancient thinking as total combustion. That this total combustion would not only have its physical significance, but its spiritual significance as well. And the atomists would probably go on to try to interpret the meaning of the possibility of an existing thing actually ceasing to exist. This would mean something entirely different from death, nothing of a parallel nature at all. It would mean the motion of a thing to the extinction of itself. The extinction of the atom can only be one procedure, one fact, and that is its total identity with vacuum. This would probably be the most incredible situation that could arise, because it would require a violation of every relationship existing in nature. Actually, probably also, when the thing is all summed down and we get through with the whole problem, we will probably discover we haven't done it. We will probably discover that what we have actually achieved is not the annihilation of an atom or the actual destruction of its own unity, which means the total violation of its own archetype, the complete sundering of relationship with pattern. But that what actually has been accomplished, or so-called accomplished, in this procedure has simply been the release of certain areas of energy which are resident in atom. Now, the Greeks do not give us this concept of a total energy present in atom, but they tell it in another way. They point out that there is only atom and vacuum, and then they create the universe. This means only one thing, that the universe has to reside in atom, just as the oak tree resides in the acorn. By the gradual process of growth, the oak tree unfolds the potential of the acorn in a quiet, reasonable, orderly manner until it attains its growth. Then this tree, in turn, has its own acorns. These, in turn, become trees. And in the course of time, if you wish to diagram this, say in 1,000 years, your single acorn would have become a great forest of trees. This would go on and on and on. Supposing, however, at the moment of the sprouting of the first acorn, within which all of this archetypal expression is locked, the absolute release of this energy was instantaneous. Instead of producing generation after generation of trees, enlarging and multiplying their number, spreading over a great area of land, perhaps ultimately creating a forest for the whole earth, supposing this entire release had been made instantaneously, instead of an orderly development of forests, there would be a sudden and inconceivable blast of power, because it is actually the power in the first acorn that may 10,000 years later still produce further trees. This power is carried from tree to tree in generation, until perhaps we can imagine that one acorn became the basis of all the oak trees that we know. But suppose that one acorn had released all its power at once, there would have been no oak trees as we know them. There would have simply been a diagrammatic blaze, a tremendous release of force. And this release of force would not be under the guidance of necessity or under the relationship of law. It would have been actually what the atomic bomb is, an instantaneous explosion. Had man not tampered with this atom, to go back now again to our Greeks, if man had not tampered with this atom might have become ultimately, through aggregation, the core of a planet. This planet, in turn, might gradually, through the continual growth of itself, become a sun. This sun, in turn, might become the central center of a cosmic system, and so on and on and on. But suddenly, the power of this atom to grow or to release energy was released instantly. Therefore, we have this tremendous instantaneous growth. But if we diagrammatically present this, what is the difference? The difference has been that the energy has been released too rapidly to permit the function of growth. Therefore, instead of expansion, we have explosion. Instead of life enriching itself, we have had it expending itself. Now, ultimately, all life must expend itself. But it expends itself in the maturity and in the final decline of its species. The arc of energy finally dies out in the extinction of forms of life. But in this case, this breaking of the patterns was a sudden release of energy. Now, it wasn't total, because I'm firmly convinced that the total release of the energy of a single atom would constitute not less than a complete solar disaster. In other words, it would take the solar system with it at least. This is only a relative degree, only a slight degree. And I am further convinced that beyond a certain degree, the processes used by man cannot operate. That it is quite impossible for man to explode or release the total potential of the atom. But that it is possible for him to do what he has done, we cannot deny. What follows? What is the result of the sudden release of the life of an atom into the field of vacuum? Is this the thing the Greek never really understood? Is the ultimate end of all atomic compound to be a dissolution by which a kind of overcharge is poured into vacuum? Does all atomic activity ultimately result in the change of vacuum? Does vacuum gradually alter its own nature? All of the atoms return to their own existence, but by the process of gathering, accumulating, building, finally dividing, and disintegrating their compounds and returning back into themselves, is this motion producing something else in vacuum? The Platonists believed it did. For they believed that the world soul, the psychic nature of existence, was built up from the constant overcharge from the atomic action into the field of vacuum, and that there gradually rose in vacuum another dimension or another factor. And this factor was the total psychic energy of the universe. And out of this factor arose what Socrates called the good, the power by means of which the infinite repetition of atomic experience resulted in the shift from the concept of necessity to the concept of morality. That first the necessary required all things. Ultimately, the good provides all things. So that the energy cycle of the atom does not exhaust itself by infinite repetition. But in this process, a plus factor is added through the cycle of growth. This plus factor continues to build a plus that is not another kind of atom primarily, but an energy or an essence. And that this essence is the secret of the ultimate release of life from the endless repetition of the atomic cycle sequence. So this is the basic thinking of the Greeks on the matter. And now that you thoroughly understand this, we will then prepare ourselves for an Asiatic evening a week from tonight. Thank you very much.